The proper introduction to John is just handed to read from where? With no setting at all. We should have begun the break with chapter 10, not chapter 11. Now when he cried with a loud voice, seven thunders uttered their voice, and when the thunders had uttered their voice, John was about to write, so that he understood what they were saying. But remember the story of Paul when he was called, there was a thunder, and Paul heard a voice and understood it, and others only heard the thunder. When Jesus heard, let's say, when Jesus had the Father say, you know, you're my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, the others heard and thought it was only thunder. There was a life, no, wait a minute, there was a Time magazine statement a number of years ago that said that Herbert W. Armstrong, you know, thunders the message of the world tomorrow. That was correct. They heard the thunder. They understood not the voice. They were more prophetic than you realize, as we now shall look. And when this happened, John was about to write. And then he hears a voice from heaven saying, you know, all this takes place from heaven because this is the origin of these events, not the earth. The angel comes down from heaven because that's the origin. But what happens is a message that is conveyed to the earth. And then John hears another voice from heaven say, seal up the things which the seven thunders have uttered and write them up. So he's told, don't write them. It's not something that has to be written. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and the earth lifted up his hand to the heaven and swore by him that lives forever and ever, who created the heaven and all the things in it, the earth and the sea, that there should now be no longer any delay after the seven thunders. Oh. There should no longer be any delay. Now, that the statement, there should be time no longer, is not an accurate translation in terms of the meaning of the word in English. The sense is there's no longer a delay of one thing just gradually taking place so much later than expected. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he has declared to his servants the prophets. So we have an indication, if you please, of the seven thunders continuing, you see, to the point in time that we finish the story with the sixth trumpet, and in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, that is the calling of the church. That is, why do we have over 19 centuries in which God has cast off the Jewish nation as a whole and seems not to be at work, as is declared to his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from heaven spoke to me again and said, go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which stood upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went to the angel and said to him, now I haven't explained all of this yet. All I'm going to do at the moment is just summarize and then pick right up again. But utter their voice. Now we know there's coming a time when there shall be a famine of the word of God. That's not described here. It's described in Amos. He says, not a famine of food, but of hearing the word of God. I just mentioned that in proceeding. But now we're told that after the seven thunders have uttered their voice, there would no longer be a delay, as we had a delay described in the seventh chapter. But when the seventh angel sounds, the whole thing would be finished. Now in the meantime, the voice which I heard from heaven said to me again, go and take the little book, open in the hand of the angel. And I went to the angel, said to him, give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it. Now, this couldn't be the book of life, because we're not eating the book of life. The man shall live by what? Every word of God. He doesn't live by bread alone. Now, it's going to be in your mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. But as soon as I had eaten it, my stomach was bitter. Because when he really understood and devoured it, and when he saw, in other words, in grass, what was to happen, it made him sick. Because he saw what was going to take place. And now he said to me, and let's not note the term chapter 11, let's just read. And he said to me, you must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And there was given me a reed like a rod. And the angel stood and said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those that worship therein. Now you see, what we have done was to split it here because chapter 11 was written there without realizing that chapter 10 and 11 fit together when you read it just like this. Because there isn't some wonder in heaven or wonder in earth that introduces chapter 11, is there? Therefore, chapter 11 is part of a total inset that is a part of 10 and not separate. And the inset begins with chapter 10. Just like chapter 12 is a separate inset, and chapter 13 has two parts, two beasts. And chapters 18, you know, and 17, they're all really a part of the whole thing. Now we understand that the Gentiles will tread down the city for 42 months. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for this duration. Two witnesses. And they have power to do this. And the two witnesses are ultimately killed. Now, you understand much of the background of this chapter, but I want to go backward again, because when you see, as you move in time backward, you'll find what really happens in chapter 10. Now, there was a great voice after the two witnesses had been killed and were dead for 3.5 days, verse 11. The spirit of life from God entered them. They stood on their feet. And chapter 11, verse 12, says, come up hither. And they ascended to heaven in the clouds. The same hour was the great earthquake. The second woe was past, verse 14. And the seventh angel sounds, verse 15. And we now read, the nations were angry, verse 18. And your wrath has come, and the time of the nations. It's incorrect to read it as death. It should be nations, ethnos, not nekros. And the time of the nations that they should be judged. That's the original reading in the Greek. And that you should give reward to your servants, the prophets, and the saints, to those that fear God's name, small and great, and those who should destroy the earth should be destroyed. All right, that's the close. The seventh angel sounds, the seventh trumpet, that's the return of Christ. That's the end of this inset. And now we go back for 3.5 years from essentially the seventh trumpet. We go back 3.5 years in time, and the two witnesses are speaking. Now, I want you to note that chapter 11 talks about two witnesses, and there is certainly a focus on Jerusalem and a temple. We don't have to define it for the moment. That's not relevant to the issue at this time. But I want you to note, before we are told that the two witnesses prophesy, we are told in chapter 10, verse 11, you must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Now, John, apparently, in his day, and John sees the vision, and it's all enacted through him. John had spoken throughout the history of the Church of God, from the time that Jesus sent his spirit in A.D. 31 to somewhere here around 95-96 A.D. And then in this vision, he is told to eat a book, and he must prophesy again before peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And then we are introduced to two witnesses. Now, the meaning of this should be very clear. But John let's say, is pictured as the one who has spoken before, and now he's told to speak again. You note that the angel had a little book. And this is in verse 2. He cried with a loud voice, and there were seven thunders. What those thunders said is not recorded. Then we are told that John should eat this little book, would be sweet in his mouth, be great to say it, but the results would be bitter in his stomach. Because what he would prophesy at the close would be a very terrible end to this world. And so he's told he must prophesy again, verse 11, as I read, and then the two witnesses are described who do this very thing. The two witnesses are then described who do this very thing. Because they're speaking before the whole world, and the whole world sees their dead bodies, verse 9, didn't allow them to be put in their graves, were very happy when they were dead, sent gifts to one another. We discover, in other words, that the two witnesses then fulfill a task in the tribulation and into the day of the Lord that has not yet been finished. And since the two witnesses are pictured here as, in a sense, fulfilling the result of what John was told to do, prophesy again before many peoples and tongues and nations and kings, we may discern what then becomes the big surprise when we look at the whole thing. That the seven thunders are finished before the two witnesses speak. Whereas we have assumed heretofore that the seven thunders were somewhat of the sixth trumpet that the two witnesses began, beginning at the tribulation. And we had assumed that chapter 10 followed chapter 9, instead of following properly that chapter 11 follows chapter 10 as an inset. Therefore, we must conclude, in looking at the layout here, that the seven thunders are not a part of the sixth trumpet, but precede the two witnesses. In fact, the seven thunders then can be nothing else, since they are the result of that little book. And I have a copy of that little book. Whether you believe it or not, you will someday. John was told, we're all told, that we must live by every word of God, and man does not live by bread alone. We must absorb this book as one would, in a sense, eat. In this case, this book in the vision was like something you could literally eat. Now, we don't eat paper, but we are to live by this just as you live by bread. Then we now conclude that the messages derived from the little book take two forms. One, they appear as seven thunders in sequence, because if you hear it seven times, that's why you hear seven. If it were all at once, you would have heard it once. But these are seven thunders in sequence followed by a redigestion, so to speak, of the book, and then the two witnesses. The seven thunders now could represent only one thing if you have gone through the book of Revelation. John and his brother James were called the sons of thunder. Time magazine said that Mr. Herbert Armstrong thunders the message of the world tomorrow. The seven thunders would therefore parallel the seven churches and are the messages of the seven churches. And if we had known this, brethren, we would have known that the seventh church or Laodicea would also have spoken before the tribulation. We assume, brethren, so let's acknowledge it. Mr. Kubik and I were discussing the fact that sometimes it's good, I'm not baring my breast, like, you know, tearing the garments, only have this one shirt and one other on the trip. And it wouldn't impress you anyway. This is not our culture. And when the sixth church, the Church of Philadelphia, was finished, that somehow, we didn't know how, because we looked around and didn't see it at that time, that somehow the congregation of Laodicea must be the people who, as co-workers, didn't go far enough, or people who were on the periphery, who will go into the Great Tribulation. And we pictured the Church of Laodicea as an organization that exists in the tribulation, see, at the time the two witnesses were speaking, because we thought that the Church of Philadelphia, described in chapter 3, the midpoint of the book of Revelation, would somehow end the work of God till the tribulation. Because we could not imagine ourselves becoming anything else. But we didn't understand the 10th chapter. If we had, we would have seen that indeed all seven thunders utter their voice. All messages of the seven churches, in fact, have spoken. And then John is told, eat this book, because you're still to speak some more. So that after the seven thunders, the messages of the seven churches have been conveyed to the world. And the messages in the book of Revelation, chapter 2 and 3, are to the churches. But each one of the churches has a message to convey to the world. Because that's their mission, that's their purpose. To bear a message to the world. This has been done in the days of the apostles. It was done during the time of Peter Waldo. It was done during the time of Constantine Mananales. It was done during the Church of God Seventh Day in the 1910s and 20s. It has been done in the 30s till now the 70s. In different forms, in different fashions. Some thunderclaps are very loud and near, and others are very distant and weak. And it all depends on the strength of the church, spiritually. We made the mistake of assuming that six messages would be conveyed to the world by six churches, and then the tribulation during which the two witnesses would be speaking into the day of the Lord, because we didn't understand chapter 10. Chapter 10 is an inset that tells us what the churches would be doing during the time that everything has been happening from chapter 6 through chapter 9. And the inset doesn't begin with 11, it begins with 10. The seven thunders don't have to be recorded, because in reality, it is unimportant that we should have to repeat the individual messages of each one of the churches to the world. The people in the Middle Ages didn't have to be concerned if they had heard that we were speaking about a Hitler or a Mussolini. We don't have to know that the church in the Middle Ages may have been speaking about Frederick the Great, or Napoleon, or Charlemagne. These were irrelevant. In fact, God may have not even decided who should play what role. Sometimes individuals fell into these roles because they wanted to. And if one did not, another one could have. In any case, there was no reason to repeat many of the individual messages through time, because after all, the main message is already in the Bible, and then prophecy is given. And that's why it is not reported here. We assume, because it wasn't, it must be some message yet to be unfolded in the day of the Lord. Whereas you see, the sequence now becomes very clear that the little book is the Bible, and the seven thunders could have no other parallel. Now, if you can find some other parallel, you tell me. But there must be a parallel of seven thunders before the two witnesses, because they have already uttered their voice, and then John is given the little book, told to speak again before men, and then he's also given a reed that introduces us to the very events right in and around Jerusalem, where the presence of the two witnesses are and the Gentiles are. And they speak again for 3.5 years, approximately, and it ends with the return of Christ. We may now look back on the history of this church. There was a time in the 1950s we would have sermons like Mr. Blackwell's on the Laodicea. And in the 1960s, Mr. Armstrong would sometimes ask the question, brethren, are only half of you converted? No. It wasn't like that. He only asked the question as a warning. Because the church was characterized as the Church of Philadelphia. That was essentially the basic state of mind. Some were lukewarm spiritually in their personal lives, or toward the work. Some were dead spiritually, though they had a name, they sat among us. Some had lost their first love. Some had hung on to one heresy or another. Some had been involved in fornication or whatever it might have been. Every one of the sins of the seven churches we could have had individually in our midst, but the characteristic of the churches were very clear. A church that basically was dead brought us to the early 1930s. Then a church which was small in number was called, and before whom God opened many doors. And there are people like that in each of those churches today. There are people alive in the Church of God Seventh Day who are spiritually dead, especially at the top, much less so at the bottom. And when Christ comes, it will be a surprise to them, but it says very plainly in chapter 4. There are people without any question in chapter 3 of the book of Revelation. To the Philadelphia era, God says, I will open the doors before you, and you must be patient, and I will provide you with protection during the time that is going to try the whole world. That's why we thought we would go right up there. Yes, indeed we are. There are people like that, of that Philadelphia state of mind, who are continuing to do the work that we have always done. But, brethren, beginning in 1972, a state of mind has been growing and has been setting in the church. It's not heresy, because the Church of Laodicea is not defined as subject to heresy. That's not its characteristic. Its characteristic is that it appears to be rich and increased with goods and not really having need of anything, but is spiritually miserable, poor, blind, and naked. That it is a church which is neither hot water on a cold day or cold water on a hot day, but is lukewarm. And it is not like the tares who were gathered to be burned, who are not wheat, but it's people that you can't separate because they're not guilty of heresy. They have the Spirit of God, or they couldn't even be the church, but they've been begotten and they don't grow. And Christ stands at the door and knocks. And he knocks in the following fashion. He says, let me come in and I will sit down with you and sup with you, right? Now he's talking about the individual personalized of people. You get my point? He doesn't say, now, like you read in the other, I have somewhat against you. If you allow this and that and something else. This is a group of people and a state of mind of those whom God calls, where individuals don't let Christ live his personal life in them, where he has to stand outside, or to put it in this actual term, when you are seated inside your home at your table with your husband or your wife or your friends or your children, you're drinking too much beer, you're eating things you ought not, you're saying things you should not, thinking thoughts you ought never to do. It's no wonder Christ is at the door. Because if he were there, you'd have to change your conversation. And many a woman would change her menu. What you would be saying to your husband or to your wife, what you'd be saying to your parents as children or children to parents, you would change the subject immediately if Christ came in. That's the state of mind of Laodicea. Brethren, that's the state of mind which leads people in God's church to separate from one another and to divorce when there is no justification, no porneia, no fraud. That's what leads people to accuse each other in the church. Or, as I have found on my trips, and I found here in the United States before, husbands who see nothing good in their wives, wives who see nothing good in their husbands. Parents who are not concerned about children, children who couldn't be concerned less toward parents. The Church of Laodicea is a picture of family breakdown because it's related to what you are doing at your table, where you are eating and Christ is standing outside at the door and knocking. It has nothing to do with the pulpit. It has nothing to do with heresy. It is a state of mind reflecting this last part of the 20th century that is creeping into the church. I saw it beginning, and I told Mr. Albert Fortune in his home in January 1972, and Mr. Neff was there. But I had to conclude that we didn't have to look among Seventh-day Adventists or any other group outside that Laodicea has come into our midst. And this is why the story ends with five wise and five foolish virgins. They're all virgins. There's not five virgins and five prostitutes. Why, there are two at the mill, two grinding, two asleep. One is taken, the other's left. That's the ultimate state of affairs. And it began at the close of two 19-year time periods. It began very clearly and was clearly noticeable in 1972. In fact, it was so noticeable at headquarters that everyone knew that something had taken place and we didn't know what. Let me make it plain, Mr. Garner Ted Armstrong was not there then. He was not there then. He was learning his own lesson somewhere else. And those who were and who allowed it, the man who was fundamentally responsible at that time, is now gone. Very sad. But now we're living in a state of mind where, in a sense, Mr. Herbert Armstrong long since gave up the battle because there was no way to spend this kind of time. 1971, 72, 73, we were speaking very commonly about the struggle between the permissive and those who were not permissive. I won't use the term liberal and conservative because that's an unfortunate misuse of terminology by the way we use it today. Those who were permissive and those who were not. Now, the interesting thing is you're dealing with human nature. And we discovered that you can't say that all of you to my right are not permissive and all of you are always permissive to my left. It doesn't work out that way. Because sometimes you may be very, very careful on some points and very permissive on others. Some people are more permissive than others, but we're not always the same on everything. And Mr. Armstrong finally was aware of the fact that we couldn't say either to laymen or to ministers that you're permissive here, but you're not, that you're always permissive and therefore have to be put out. It's not something we could act on in terms of church government. And that's why it has occurred in our midst, because there was no way to stop it. It is the result of living in this century with the impact of wealth and prosperity, of television, the movies, radio, the newspapers, the magazines, the paperbacks, the schools, the churches, everything. There was a time when people could come to this congregation and they'd ask us questions about the Bible. Now their only concern is about their own problems. There was a time when a minister, if he left his Bible in the briefcase in the car, within 10 minutes, as we used to say, both the individuals in the home and the minister knew he had forgotten it. Today, if he did the same thing when the meeting is over, neither person has realized it, because they weren't talking about what the Bible was saying. They were only discussing their problems. That's our society. There was a time we would ask people, and that's why I'm sure Christ allowed the ruling on divorce to stand as long as it did, even if it were erroneous and shouldn't have been. There was a time that we would say to people who had been divorced and remarried and divorced and or remarried, didn't your parents warn you? Didn't your teacher say something? Didn't your minister? Didn't your friends? Yes. So we went and did it anyway. Today we ask the same question. Didn't your parents warn you? Didn't your minister? Didn't your teacher? Didn't your friends? No. Nobody ever told us it was wrong. But everybody else was doing it. We didn't know. Now, admittedly, it was an error administratively. But Christ sometimes allows it for the simple reason that most people in the 30s and 40s and 50s, yes, even into the 60s, who were involved in sex sin, that's what it is, they knew best. Now, some were innocent victims and did pay a very heavy penalty because of mistaken judgment and decision of the church, where we were wrong and we should acknowledge it. We didn't imagine that Christ would let this kind of a mistake be made at the highest level in this Armstrong thinking. But brethren, the fact remains that most people who were involved in sex before marriage knew better and were guilty because they knew better before they did it. And today they don't, because it's the thing, the in thing to do. And it's now come to the place where Christ could not even allow this kind of administration to go on because people don't know any better. What we're saying is that there is this great trend and shift in society, and it inevitably comes into the church. There are people who, to this day, wouldn't want their private lives known in terms of their public. Mr. Armstrong said to me, now probably 1 to 2 years ago in his office, I don't have many private talks with him, maybe once or twice a year for that matter. He said 3 words and 3 words only to me on this subject, and we passed to another. And I didn't say anything to him. You can quote me. Laodicea is here. The seventh thunder is being thundered around the world. And it's done at the same time with two kinds of people, 5 wise and 5 foolish, are side by side. Ultimately, I don't think it's that percentage now. I think it's much more like 7-3. It'll soon be 6-4, and then it's 5-5. That's the way it will go. Started out probably 9-1, 8-2, and it's moving in that direction because more and more people are coming in. And don't assume that just because you came in since 72, now let me clarify that so nobody misunderstands. I'm just saying you have a far greater problem if you are younger and influenced, no matter when you are converted, than people who went through the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Second World War period, or the Korean War. But we are all influenced by the same television. I don't care what your age. But there's a greater danger, inevitably, if you're younger and never lived through the crisis of the 30s and the 40s, or the earliest 50s, when you are wholly influenced by all the modern environment, there's a greater danger. But two congregations are in our midst, and there's another one not in our fellowship, the Church of God Seventh Day, like the Sardis era. We're all three on earth now, at least, if not fragments of earlier remnants somewhere in Europe and the Middle East. That I won't address. The two people are doing this work. God has set an open door before the congregation of Philadelphia. And we are to complete a task that we didn't know that somewhere in the middle everything would be stopped, as it once was temporarily between 71 and 72. In the personal life, in the crisis in Mr. Ted Armstrong's life. And it was at that time in the administration of some men who are not now administering that this other trend took root. And one of the intents of that was to oust Mr. Ted Armstrong and to oust Mr. Herbert Armstrong. It didn't work. God opened the door before Philadelphia, and he will choose to close it. But just because the peculiar characteristic of our society, and therefore it's going to take place in the church, because God calls people out of society, and when you're buried in baptism, you don't change everything. You may attempt to, but you don't. There are many things you carry and still have to repent of as the knowledge comes. But probably Paducah is less influenced than Hollywood is by the world. I think Kentucky is not the leader in Laodicea, even in the world around me. I think that's just the nature of our environment. But I want to warn you that this is the drift. And therefore, be very careful how you fit in judgment, because with what judgment you judge others, you're going to be judged. But you have to realize that God purposed to call people now where this becomes the permitted, and those who are not so permissive are here together. The work must be finished. The seven thunders utter their voice, and then the two witnesses. Because we now see that the introduction to the two witnesses in chapter 11 began not with verse 1 of chapter 11, but with verse 1 of chapter 10. I hope, brethren, that you see this perspective, because it answers many questions. I think it would lay aside many doubts. When we are face to face with reality in our midst, this doesn't change the spiritual state of those who are faithfully doing the work and who faithfully let Christ live his life in them and who will be delivered. But when Mr. Ted Armstrong has to warn that a lot of people in our midst are not going to be delivered, that's also true. And some of the things that you think you have heard that are contradictory are because there are two kinds of people in the church today, at least. Two major ones. Those where Christ lives his life in them, and those where he stands at the door and knocks. Now, if you have ears to hear and eyes to see, you will let Christ in if he isn't there. You would pick up the conversation at the tables, just where you left it off, and in fact, ask Christ to answer some of the very questions you were discussing. You won't embarrassingly suggest we change the topic. And that's the difference in the attitude. It's an issue of attitude of heart and mind.